Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Oh.
Winter, spring, summer, fall, seasons change, we still keep it together.
Hey, Beverly Hills 90210 fans, are you ready to dive deep? Episode by episode, storyline by storyline, character by character, as we break down the making of your favorite zip code with your host. Charles
Rosen.
Did I say that?
Yeah. Mary Mullen. This heinous thing about the real person, and we go, what? We're getting rid of this guy.
Pete Ferrero.
I'm feeling wonderful. Kathleen looks crush, TV crush worthy.
Like so many special guests and all your questions. Live on the Beverly Hills 90210 show. Oh, yeah.
Okay, here we are back again on the Beverly Hills 90210 show, this time covering Home Again, a season one episode. Lots to talk about there. Charles, how is everything going in Venice Beach these days?
Oh, well, I'm busy. In fact, I had a very, as a writer, I had a pretty good weekend in that there's a important publication that in LA here called City Watch LA that published a piece that I wrote about the Venice Median. And so did the West Side Current this morning. And it was called Changing the Conversation about the Venice Median, because what we did is there are 8 people running to replace our discredited councilman who keeps trying to push this through. And we got 6 out of the 8 candidates to respond. The other 2 didn't respond, but the 6 who responded all said to join us and please tabling this, postpone it till one of them are elected. So wow. We've actually changed the entire conversation, not asking to talk about California Coastal Environmental Review, not talking about obligations to the public that they had, the city council had, that they didn't follow through with,
right,
et cetera. We're just saying, guys, nobody wants this. Stop listening to this discredited councilman. Mike Bonin is his name.
Yes.
And we got it out today. So as soon as we're finished today, I'm going to send out probably an email blast to about 200 Venetians asking them to contact these council people and ask them to abstain. So we'll see what happens, but at least it gives you a generation. You mean to, you know, get generated with some energy, because what am I doing? Larry's in the East Coast. I don't know what I'm doing every morning, you know.
I know what you mean.
What do you mean? He's not here. Where am I going to walk the dogs? What am I doing? Who am I talking baseball with?
You know? We got a lot of questions. Where's Chuck? Is Chuck okay? Chuck is fine. He's doing his thing in Venice.
Larry or me?
No, you. Larry. People are saying it's Chuck. Because like, well, now they'll ask me about Larry because Larry's not on with us this week. Is Larry okay? Where is, you know what I mean? But yeah. But you're doing great. You're just very busy in Venice Beach right now.
Very busy, and felt, you know, in terms of these podcasts that we've covered so much.
Yes.
That Pete and I think you confirm this, that we said, look, let's do watch alongs, because that I get to see the episode again, refreshes, stimulates memory, sees, formulates opinions.
Sure.
About, well, what are we seeing? And then do a short conversation afterwards about it. And that's what this is today.
Exactly.
And it's just a way to round out because, you know,
we're keeping it.
He has so many topics he can interview people on. You know, we got to help him move along.
Exactly. So, yeah. But we're keeping it going. And this is one way we can with you. And it's always exciting. All right. Let's talk about Home Again. And yeah. I'm sure for fans out there, I'm sure we'll try to do a Charles and Larry at some point too. We'll get everybody at some point back together, reunited.
So reunited?
Yeah.
I always seeing that everybody dance now inspires me to do it, and I'm, you know, later we'll sing "Celebrate Me Home," but right, reunited, and it's understood,
and it is.
We'll have that. We will have that.
All right, cool. So let's talk about Home Again. Now, what I love about Home Again, what we talked about on the watch along, was that it is sort of a good ender of the season, right? It feels like a good closure on the season. In case 90210 didn't come back, it was a good ending. Having said that, it was coming back. Do you know, I was thinking about this morning, do you know when you knew you would even be doing Home Again and Spring Dance? We always talk about the first six. Then we talk about the first 12, but inevitably there was 22 that season. So there had to be another order at some point, right?
Good question. Well, what the orders were two scripts at a time. Mm-hmm. Didn't get it. They, you know, Fox, as we've talked about, and financially was pretty overextended. Rupert Murdoch put all the money down to buy the satellite in England, and he just didn't have it. So they didn't want to start and they're a penurious company. So they did not want to make a big cash outlay or commitment to the production, not knowing how we would be doing, but they had to keep it going. So, you know, they would give us an order for two, then two more, then I think three more. But a couple of weeks after the, that we came back after the Gulf War with the kind of numbers that we were getting, and, you know, about 750,000 to 1 million new viewers every episode. It was clear, just as we've talked about, I expected we'd have the normal summer break and go right into it, and was ready to go to Fox and even said, oh, I'm ready to pitch you, you know, what I did on my summer vacation. And of course, that became the title of what Larry and I did to start season five, because they had other plans to do the summer episode. So it was around the time that we were starting to put these stories together. I think the key to remember this late season and these episode order in late of season one is to put in perspective that they wanted a cliffhanger. This was very important to these brilliant network minds, and it's what they just oriented for. So I worked hard to think about, well, what would be the cliffhanger? And the cliffhanger that made most sense to me was the teenage girl's biggest fear of saying, of their own sexuality, which is, I am late.
Right.
They said, oh, that'll be a good one. And we ran that down to standards and practices, the censors, with us knowing that.
Sorry.
With us knowing, oh, you're taking my role.
That's never happening. Yeah.
But that we were not going to, that I wasn't that interested in I was as interested in the idea of the cliffhanger, but even more interested in the idea that Brenda would have to tell her father she's sexually active. I think we've talked about that before. I knew a girl in high school who had to tell her father the same thing.
Right.
And she talked to me about the poignance of that moment. Because she was a teen. She was 16, you know, a young girl to say, you know, relatively to say that. And so so I knew that there'd be drama. And I knew that we would have a great cliffhanger. What we didn't know was, oh, she's going to have to lose her virginity. So Spring Dance.
At some point, right, that would have to happen, right.
Mm-hmm. So Spring Dance factored into that. Mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing that you and I discovered, yes, Home Again, if the show had only lasted 1 year, this is where you would have wanted to end the series.
Totally.
This was, you know, oh, they're going back to Minnesota. And even though in yesterday's watch along, I kind of, was disparaging about the whole idea that the Walshes were going to leave. But because if that happened, then there's no series. But, you know, given the precarious nature of our ratings for a while, certainly the fans could believe that maybe this show isn't coming back.
Sure.
And so, you know, so with that in mind, we really focused on the idea of, you know, that here's the, so I think there is some legitimacy to the fact of the series itself. And when it did, I feel the episode, two things it did really, really cemented. One was how the Walshes now were all in Beverly Hills. There was no more, at least for the time being, there was no Minneapolis nostalgia.
No.
They had moved here. They're now part of the scene. Telling viewers, be confident. We want to be here. These are our friends. This is what we want.
Particularly Cindy, Brandon, and Brenda. You know, Jim Walsh is apparently very flexible and can go back to Minnesota. You know what I mean? He didn't seem to, but by the end of it, he definitely wants to be.
Well, he was induced by, they were doubling his salary once he said no.
Right.
And so, you know, he made an administrative decision. I'm going back. He went to try it out and he was just inundated. He just did not have a life. Now, the thing that was, that he did not take into account, and we weren't going to let the character take it into account, is the fact that, well, they were just, we knew they were in disarray. People were getting fired. Things were happening. It was all this paranoia in Los Angeles. Company's not doing that well. So they throw a lot on his plate. And he does say, and I've heard this before, I was doing the job of three people.
I mean, you could probably say that about yourself at times at 90210.
Five people. Right. But a lot of corporate people, it certainly in the network, in fact, it became a problem in network television, less so while we were doing the show, but at the end of the decade and into the aughts, when the networks were scrambling to try to see where their profit centers would be, they definitely cut back on the amount of lower and middle level executives they had. So the ones that you would be dealing with on pilots were so overwhelmed that it was very hard for them to get their attention in the way that it was in the 80s or in the early 90s when there were more staff and more flush. So I think that's one thing, that commitment to we want to be in California. And the other I found interesting, which we talked about a little bit yesterday, but you know, you look at our cast of characters at this time, at the end of season one. So clearly, oh my gosh, Brenda's going back. And yes, her girlfriends are going to miss her, but it's about her and Dylan.
Totally.
They've already become sexually active. They don't know what to do. They're, you know, she's feeling very bad. She's, you know, and you see those scenes, but we also realized that Brandon, you know, he was tethered with Steve and Andrea, and they were the ones who really factored into this storyline. Mm-hmm. Steve were feeling like, God, I've been burned. I've invested in this friend and he doesn't, and not there. And also to show something that's very truly was Beverly Hills at the time, which is how if you were a child of famous people, how you were teased, harassed.
Right. Because
not so much in high school, but certainly the middle school, elementary school. I remember some of those, you know, and showbiz kids acting different than others. And certainly Steve fell into that.
Right off the top of the episode, that starts out with a fight where Steve is either defending his mom's honor or defending his inheritance. One of the two, right?
We came to that conclusion yesterday, yes. But here's the other, that with Andrea, how just she just knowing that this was the guy who she first had really amorous feelings for was leaving, and she makes an initiative to give herself away as a going away present to Brandon, that she wanted this. So did Brandon. And they walked into that peach pit, assuming that's going to happen. And yet it was the surprise.
Right. Yeah.
Now I bring this up, Pete, for this reason, because that at that point in the status of the show, and you pointed out, boy, Tori had nothing to do.
She was barely mentioned. I mean, she was, maybe she had a lunch, you know.
And that was kind of true of Kelly and David, too.
Yes. David was holding a video camera, really.
Yes, and Kelly was dealing with him. And that, so the pecking order of who was what, even in the start, even, you know, with Kelly being the sweetheart, the blonde, you could see where the orientation was, that Donna had not been an important character yet. You know, we Kelly doesn't really have a major episode in season two until she gets to Halloween.
That's right.
Where she dresses too sexy. So again, she's being reprimanded for being a girl with sexuality. But if you really think about most of season two, it is not oriented to her.
No.
It would be, of course, once the triangle starts.
Sure.
Then she shifts away. And Donna just kept, you know, getting many episodes with fewer lines. But she did get, you know, starting in season one, her own subplot with being a learning disability.
Sure.
And then it went on. And then by the time we start season three, she's going to France. Season two, she gets together with David, of course. So it's another profile. And then, of course, she's going to be in Paris with Brenda. And she's a whole other set of relationships, too. So everybody got more to do because, as you pointed out, wow, the parents sure had a lot to do in this episode. And it's because season one, it was the Walsh family series.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. So it's interesting, though. So would you say then at the end of that first season, the pecking order of characters anyway was Andrea, Dylan, obviously Brandon, Brenda, Andrea, Dylan, and Steve?
Yes, would be the next group. Well, Dylan would be the next group. Then right under that, Andrea and
Steve.
Steve. And then the last three. So I think that's how it would
be. Kelly, Donna, David. You know,
and maybe. I didn't realize that until watching it. And then I also remembered that this was not the last show that we had shot. That
right.
It feels like it would be because...
Definitely.
You know, it's the cliffhanger. It's where we had to do that and end it. But we actually, because of the nature of the scope of the production and everything, that we ended with the last thing we produced was Spring Dance. And, you know, which is a much bigger profile. And it was where, of course, Brenda and Dylan made love, had sex. And so this one was, of course, after that had already happened.
It's interesting too because of the season one, and a very long time ago we did an episode, well, the very first episode we did I think was with Darren Star and Sandy Grushow, and we talked about you guys going to battle with the network for that storyline for Brenda to lose her virginity, and you guys talked about why that was really important and the network fighting back on all of that. So that was all happening while Home Again was sort of in play too, but you need one to happen with the other. It can't happen one without the other.
Well, only course correction on that, Pete, was that the conflict was not over her being late or losing her virginity at all. The network signed Dan McDermott, who said you need a cliffhanger. Dan signed off on it. Now the president of AMC television,
mm-hmm.
he signed off on it.
You're talking about in Home Again, the cliffhanger saying, I'm late. Dan McDermott signed off on that. Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, and yes. And that meant the loss of, you know,
at some point,
they're going to be doing that. We had some pushback afterwards. You know, mm-hmm. that's when it aired, and they didn't expect that some of the network affiliates and their viewers would be so negative about it. But you know, Fox had nowhere to go with this because they know that I worked hand in hand with Darlene Liblick, who was my representative from Standards and Practices, and her boss at the time, Roland McFarlane, who'd been there for many, many years. And I got their approval. They signed, they were independent. They signed off. We moved forward. And then when after the moments I'm late or the sexuality, after the sexuality itself being shown at the prom, certain stations went crazy. I always remember the one from St. Louis because they kept talking about this Bible thumper out there in Missouri who just was furious and I guess put a lot of pressure on Barry Diller. I don't know to know, but I do know that the next week comes up. They, relative to Home and Again, they spend all week promoting the shit out of it, because that's what they really do very well at Fox, even when they didn't have that much money to, you know, either support the shows or do certain things. But they put that whole part of I'm late. They did it this. And then
all the promo packages leading up to the week of that Home Again episode, it's being I'm late is the focus.
By the way,
why I'm watching it, because I just watched last week and saw what happened. Of course, I'm watching this next week.
So they did that for 4 days. And then on the day that it was going to air, and we were airing on Thursday nights in those first 2 years, something like 3 hours before the airtime, and you know, right up to the airtime itself, they had decided to cut this 30 seconds out of our show and cut that out, that whole scene.
I'm late. Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about, I'm thinking about it now, 30 years later, at the time I was, this is censorship. This is the worst thing. How could you do this? Why did anybody call me?
Well, it's also a blind side, though, in a way, too. So it's not even.
And that happens to be my pet peeve in life.
Yeah, but it's a big blind side. You know what I mean?
And they cut it out. So it's censorship. They didn't tell anybody. They just decided to do it. I got definitely reacted very strongly and,
I'm sure.
And demanded a meeting with Jamie Kellner, who was a top executive at Fox, who had to do with station relations and all sorts of other matters like that. And we had a very tense meeting in Sandy Grushel's office, which later hurt my career because Jamie Kellner became the head of the WB. And mm-hmm. Dawson's Creek was no picnic for Charles. Thank you, right. Jamie. and never was asked to go back and work for the WB.
Right.
So mm-hmm. that's where that's at. But be that as it may, you know, I can now understand that they got the best of both worlds. They promoted. But when the actual broadcast came, they didn't put anything that would lance the emotions of the station heads, like the guy from St. Louis or the conservatives in our audience that were outraged that we took the sexuality to its logical conclusion. So the big moment, of course, Diller is furious and he calls everybody together in the staff and he spews about how could they do this, because the fear was, boy, here's this low-rated TV show that's finally found its niche, that's
yes.
finally got critical support, that's finally got all these things happening.
And the generations with it, they get it, they understand
issues. Their fear was new people were coming to the show, and this is what a lot of letters said, and what they're greeted with is Fast Times at Ridgemont High. They're Fast Times. That's
right.
Not what they had been told about our show. They had been told, they deal social issues, and it's very good, and it's very, you know, and it's got
wholesome.
And it's got that spelling touch, which, although, you know, he was known for his racy stuff for primetime, it was still primetime.
Yes.
This is an R-rated material. I think more than once, Brandon Walsh says in the course of the 5 years I'm running the series, mouthpiecing me, I'm a PG kind of guy.
Yeah, he does say that.
Because we're doing, when you do... network television in that era, you were doing PG or PG-13 television.
Definitely closer to 13 later on. Yeah.
Well, yes, certainly. Yeah. Once it became, once the show became serialized in college, and then I'm sure what followed the last 5 seasons, yes, it was PG-13 for sure.
I want to ask you about this issue, this incident where, everybody doesn't, you're blindsided. You don't know. A lot of people don't know it's going to get cut. Does Mr. Spelling know that it's going to be cut?
Yes. He was the one who was called and he did not want to hear from me. So he did not call me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the first time he and I talked about it was a Saturday night. Give you all perspective of what we're doing. That Saturday night, I'm home in my back house working with the newly hired writer, Jonathan Roberts, whose name's been mentioned. The writer went on to write The Lion King. And we're working together in the house when the call comes. And I, like, you know, like, what took you so long?
I'm curious, a couple days later, have you calmed down about this at all, or is it still a hot button for you?
It's a hot button, and it remains so. It remains so a hot button for me until we were able to do everybody's talking about it.
Makes sense.
And remember, things that they asked to do, well, make it that you won't have any more sexuality, that you're sorry about it. This Darren wrote that episode, coming right straight back. He did a beautiful job on it. And I've said in the context of this show that I would have never been able to write that episode at the time. I was just, because Darren was brand new to TV, and I'd been in the business by that point for 14 years. So I knew what was standard and what wasn't standard and what was fair and what wasn't fair. And that this was not the way that you would treat people. Anyway, Spelling calls and I don't let him off the hook. I said, why didn't you call me? Why didn't you call me sooner in this? And he was very upset because the fish in his koi pond were dying. He told me that night and I still didn't let him off the hook. And Spelling said to me something that was the truest thing about me that he said that up until that point, nobody had said quite so succinctly. Is he said, you know, because if I quit, he's in trouble.
That's right. Big trouble. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Darren, he had other things. There were other writers now. But what I said to him was, what he said about me is he said, you'd be nothing without your passion. And later I would think about that because whenever I was not passionate about something, you could see it on the page. You could see it in the language. Mm. You know, yes, I was a pro. I could get things done and there were professionally written scenes and this. But when I was passionate about something, like a movie, a pilot I did for Fox called Soulmates, I basically came up with the idea and 2 days and wrote it in 4 days and kind of thing.
Even the storyline,
how it always is when you can run through something fast, it's good news.
Even the storyline with Suzanne and Dylan and the money swindling, you know what I mean? Like that was thought out and well, and you must've been super passionate about how this is going to work, especially when he said, they'll see it right from the beginning. Now it's like, now you have to show them that it's not going to be seen from the beginning. Right. Right. Yeah. But so, I mean, that happens. And at some point, we talked about this in the watch along. At some point they must have, because the episode I have has the I'm late in there. So at some point they did switch that, right?
Yes, they had to have restored. Well, we think so. That's something maybe some of the fans will buzz in and let you know the answer to that. Because remember, I got an air copy. What was always given to me was the air copy. And the air copy was tampered. The airing was tampered with.
Wait, so your air copy had it in or did not have it in?
Oh, definitely had it in.
It had it in. That's what makes it so wild. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it aired. Did you watch it when it aired? Is that how you... Were you watching it when it aired, or you had gotten the call already that this was not going to air the way that you thought it was going to?
No, we learned. I don't remember the answer to that. I think it's that I wasn't told.
And you're probably watching the show.
Probably my first call would have been to Kenny Miller. What the fuck is going on here? Mm-hmm. And then that's probably when I was told. Maybe Kenny called me before to tell me this is going on, but I don't and maybe Spelling asked him to. I don't know what kind of memory he is. If you ever want to have Ken Miller on this show, do it.
I will try to get him. Yeah,
just don't have me on the same show.
Of course. I think a story that fans are not going to get, but you've told me before, is that, and you just said it, is that in the midst of this back and forth over the episode and why wasn't it airing and all that, he started to talk about his two koi fish that were in his pond or something, right? And he would, that one was very sick and it was passing away and he tried to
You're saying too. I think he had many more fish that were done. I have no, I never swam in his koi pond. I never know how many.
But that's what he was maneuvering out of the conversation by talking about his koi fish.
Well, he wanted to know that I'm upset too, Charles. I'm upset about my koi, you know?
All right. So for the Brandon Andrea fans, We see Andrea do some stuff. You know, she's dressed really nice and really hot, looking really hot in this stuff. What do you think of that storyline as you look back on the Brandon Andrea aspect of this? What did you think of that?
I thought a lot of the storylines in running up and down this episode were spot on. And I think that's a tribute to how Amy Spies approached the characters, our writer Amy. Amy, I wanted to come back a lot. She decided not to. And went on with to Darren to work on Melrose.
Yeah. I mean, she
and Darren remain much closer friends than he and I do at this point. Not that I'm going to New York. I leave on Wednesday and hope to see him because that's where he's producing his show. So,
yeah,
on his calendar. It's
not to minimize your friendship with Darren's because you guys still get along all these years later.
Respect him and like him a lot.
Yeah, he's done a lot of great work, and he's important to the story. But Amy does
he's very funny man. He's got a great self-deprecating sense of humor. I enjoy being around him. He's too busy, can't hang out enough. I tell him he works too hard.
Yeah, but as for Amy though, she does really get these characters. There's a lot of fans of Amy Spies' writing, and I think it does come together really nicely. This entire episode.
Yeah, I think all the ones she did, I would say that about. I say that she got, and maybe we'd go back and look at that one, the one about the poetry, and yeah. she got hamstringed. We wanted to do poetry, and they made us make Brenda, you know, wanting to be a stand-up comedian, which was really tough. Character ever was, and it was a won the network medal on us on that one.
She's not very funny, Brenda.
Well, not that kind of funny.
Right.
She's... not that, you know, finding the joke.
Yeah. The other thing we talked about too on Patreon was the shots of on the pier, right? We talked about that they didn't love you then because of the shots of the.
Oh, brand. I made it. Well, there was a very. The Santa Monica Pier at that point, this was the 1991. Los Angeles, let's just face it, Los Angeles was a very dangerous city. You know, the whole thing that people can associate the Rodney King riots and things like that. That came after this. But what was going on this time, the Bloods and the Crips were killing each other over turf and crack cocaine. And one of the places they battled was the Santa Monica Pier in and out that area. They're called mm-hmm. the Shoreline Crips. And they were right there, a Venice-based gang, by the way. And that's where that was. So, yes, Paul didn't like seeing Brenda and Dylan in bed. Paul didn't like... where I made him film, but you know, I think that filming on the carousel, the same carousel that was used in The Sting, the famous one in Santa Monica, it was definitely worth it. And I think the whole bobbing up and down and it was very fun, done so well. We've talked about Amy, the director Chuck Braverman, who really made his mark on 90210 with and certainly the bonded with working most closely with Darren on the episode of Slumber Party, you know, had really just continued to build up his credibility in this season one, and certainly did a really nice job with that, letting the silence, and got a great performance out of our friend Gabrielle Carteris.
She's incredible in this. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. she really is. And we also made praise of the hair and makeup and wardrobe, of course. Diane Kennedy's.
She did a wonderful job. I want to touch upon something you just said because I don't know if we really drove that home, that Paul Wagner was not happy with because in Spring Dance, we, you know, the sex is not really. I mean, we know that they had sex, right? But in Home Again, we see them actually in bed together. Implying that we really kind of know that they had sex, right? And so Paul Wagner was not thrilled with that.
Well, he left it to the imagination in the other one. Yet we're in the room, and what's going to happen? And they start kissing, and that's basically. And after the second year during season two, when we had some real restrictions on us, and even in this episode that we're talking about with Spring Dance at that moment. That's basically the Hays Code. That's basically how they did it with treated sexuality in the movies, American movies of the 1930s and 40s. You knew what they were doing. You just pan off.
Yeah.
And mid 50s, all the way really to the early 60s. And then the Hays Code opened up a little bit.
So, but Paul was not thrilled with this.
He didn't want me to do it much. He just said, I don't like, he said, listen, I really don't like seeing him to bed like that. It's a little distasteful. And probably what happened, there were a few, how do I say this diplomatically? There are a few conservative turds who are on our crew, mm-hmm. and who were also a little older than some of the other members of our crew. And they probably said something to Paul that they didn't like the fact that I was sexualizing a female character.
Sure. Okay. So
that was what they were thinking about.
That's where they were going with that. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank God you did it, because it led us wanting more.
And we did not do it very often. If you think of the characters, you know, whoever was found in bed, you know, I know that when we did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, yes, Kelly and Brandon woke up together in bed.
Yeah,
I don't think we did. I don't think we did that with many characters.
No, I mean, it was a big moment. If we did, yes. Yeah, I'm going to talk to Carol Potter shortly, and we talked a little bit about them all fitting in. But Cindy Walsh really fits in this episode here. We talked about the hair and makeup and the wardrobe and all that. She is Beverly Hills, and she's the third vote. She does not want to go, right?
Well, Beverly Hills / California.
Right, exactly.
She was going to do an herb garden. She was couldn't wait to plant. She had been doing her composting. You know, the value, people move to L.A., and what they like about L.A., climate change notwithstanding, is the weather. So that was, you know, so she had come around to see that and realized that she got to know Brandon and Brenda's friends, that even the ones who were a little more troubled, risque, like Kelly's mom, you know, that she learned to appreciate them, and this, mm-hmm. she fit in with it. And you know, that I think that we established, and so not that surprising. And I thought, but what you and I both did remark of how attractive she looked, in that she looked much more like a California mother than a frumpy mother from, you know, some point in the Midwest.
All right, let's talk about this. So did you get to watch any of this episode?
Yes. As usual, though, my mind is like a complete blank. As far as what was going on during this, although this is the kind of episode where if you don't know your show is being picked up yet, can strike terror in your heart, right? Oh shit, they're sending us back to Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about that first. Do you remember, because the first season's weird, right? Like there's 12 episodes and they only give you a couple more, then a couple of more. So was it weird for you that first year? Maybe weird's not the right word, but what was it like that first year of uncertainty?
Well, yeah, we had no idea. We certainly were not expecting it to be the smash that it became, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, my only hint was I had a 14-year-old niece who lived up in Berkeley, and the only reason she and her friends were watching the show was because I was on it.
Right.
And it was their favorite show.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only, you know, slight indication that maybe there was something going on here. But I think it took Fox a little while to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so, I mean, the first year you're sort of like, oh, I'm so glad I have a job.
Right. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Long term. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as an actor, you don't expect something that you're doing to suddenly become a huge hit. It's such a rare thing, right?
Yeah.
There's so many pilots done and so many, you know, one season, even two season shows that just, you know, fall into oblivion. So, you know, we had no idea what was coming. And, you're just focused on, well, let's, you know, doing the work and trying to live your life at the same time, which can be difficult. I got married that fall.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I missed my rehearsal dinner because
you're shooting 90210.
they changed the shooting schedule, and suddenly I was working that day.
Well, because they booked some summer episodes. I think that was the thing that they.
Well, right? They started in July. So we had a very short, hiatus. Normally I have a nice chunk of time, but they started showing episodes in the summer because they knew that teenagers are out of school. Mm. And they knew they were getting the hint that, oh, the teenagers like this show. So they did, they started in showing shows in July. And they did 30 episodes that second season. Insane!
I know.
30 episodes.
I don't even think we get 6 of our favorite show these days.
It's going completely the other direction, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when you were told they picked it up, that it's going to be coming back?
I believe, I remember one moment that we got a 2-year pickup, but that might have been in the third season. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't even know how I found out, whether it was an email or it was on set.
Probably.
Yeah, because I mean, the kids, you look at this episode and I read the episode, but then I would focus on my section. So I completely forget all of the other stuff that's right. Going
you're only
on.
Focused on you.
Yeah. And so you're just focused on your stuff and getting it right and doing your best. And I mean, it was lovely working with Jim. I always enjoyed working with him. He was the most common scene partner.
That's right. Always. Yeah. In terms of watching this episode, Chuck and I said that Cindy felt more at home here now in Beverly Hills. And she even the makeup and the wardrobe she's a part of this.
More relaxed. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. She's a part of it. Do you remember feeling even that as yourself as an actor? Like I'm fine. I have found this person by this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember, because I remember the whole thing about, I was really into gardening, mm-hmm. right? It was fun to have an activity that was mine. And, developing this relationship with my housekeeper and, so it reminded me of that whole storyline, which was a lot of fun. Really enjoyed that. And I think that that's why Cindy's really feeling more connected there, is because she can, there's things that she can really do here in Beverly Hills that she can't do in Minnesota because the summer's too short. You can do a certain amount, but and you've got all winter,
mm-hmm.
to do stuff. And the fresh fruit. I mean, I feel that way when I think about going somewhere else. It's the fresh fruit that I feel difficult to leave. I'm going to go to the farmer's market later and get fresh strawberries that you can't buy in a store.
I know.
They're too fragile.
I know what you mean. Yeah. It's only out here that we can get that experience, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And my son lives in Seattle. He hates LA, even though he was born and raised here, but he misses the fruit.
Of course. Yeah. That's a reason to come back from Seattle.
That's right.
You should pitch that to him.
I think his wife would come. She likes warm weather.
Yeah. It's not really nice weather in Seattle, is it?
It's rainy a lot.
Yeah.
The summer's great. It's sunny in the summer and it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it rains a lot in the winter and it's gray a lot too.
What's your thoughts on this season? That's the end of that first season. And the kids were still they were obviously growing in popularity, but they still were probably grounded in terms of the fact that they didn't know what was going to happen and they got here. Right. So what were they like at this point?
I remember enjoying both of them really well. I mean, all the kids, working with them. And this was before there were the tabloid headlines.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
All of that stuff, which I frankly didn't pay too much attention to. As long as people were on the set and doing what they needed to do, that was that was what was important. But yeah, everything was, the gears were moving, you know, it was nice, meshed together. I felt like we were forming a nice sort of family unit, and then the additional kids. I love that Cindy was, you know, she wanted her home to be the hangout place.
Yes, that's right.
And I love that she has that impulse. And it's a wonderful impulse to have when you have teenagers, is to have, you know, this is the place where all the kids hang out.
The first season is really about the family, the Walsh family.
Yes.
And you guys really do a great, you and Jim do a really good job of making it feel like a real family. I think without the two of you, it's hard to, I mean, they're great. Don't get me wrong, but it just has to function all together. And I think you two do a really lovely job, especially in this.
I think that even after the first season, they really wanted the parents, because we're the good parents, right?
Totally.
All the other, you know, moms and dads are a little flaky in one way or another.
Sure.
And so I think they tried to use us as kind of sort of linchpins, that it sort of formed a grounding for not just our kids, but for the whole crowd. You know, totally. even if we weren't that active in the episode, I think you'll see that a lot of, you know, they'll come back home and have dinner, right?
Totally.
And even if we're not having a big conversation, there's that sense of coming home. There's a holding environment that the parents provide. And I think what they did when they sent us to Hong Kong was they transferred that holding environment to the house.
Yes.
And the house became the place of stability and foundation for the kids.
And Joey Tata's character, Nat, became
became a stronger adult sort of influence. And
yeah.
But it's really good for teenagers and young adults to have other adult figures in their life that aren't their parents.
People
can be their parents, but don't have that same investment in their own agenda, right?
Yeah, for sure. I'm curious, when you look at this character, Cindy, is this mom and all of this, and people, I'm sure, recognize you still to this day as her, right? I'm sure you get that.
I do sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. And this mom that everybody sort of identifies with, right? It's almost like the modern Brady Bunch, but way different, way, way different. But you know what I'm saying. But it's pop culture.
She used to refer to me as the Donna. What's her last name? The Donna Reed of the 90s.
Yeah. And she's like, and it's become so significant in pop culture, right? And what is your feeling on some of that, how that happened for you as one of the parents?
Well, it's really kind of astonishing and mind-blowing to think about. I mean, I would get letters from people, and, you know, or I would, you know, people would recognize me, to think about what this sort of icon in a way means to a lot of these people. I was hanging out with a bunch of friends at a gathering we were at, and there was a young man there that I had was just getting to know. I knew some of the other people a lot longer, and somebody in that group made a comment about 90210, right? Mm-hmm. Laughed, and this guy is sitting there and his jaw fell to the floor, because he was going, I kept looking at you and thinking, there's something about her that's so familiar. And then he said, you were my other mom during high school. And it's wild to think that, you know, this little show I did had that kind of impact on people, that it gave them another place where they could look for some kind of maternal nurture of some kind, right?
Yeah.
Maybe they were getting it home, but this amplified it, or maybe they weren't quite getting it home. You know, adults go through hard times, and it's hard to be a parent when you're going through a hard time, right?
For sure. And the thing is, it's interesting too, is because there's probably a handful of you that can really say you're the iconic TV moms, right? I mean, there's definitely been TV moms and we're aware of all them, but there's a handful of them. And it's a really, is it a responsibility? Is there something that you always feel the need to offer advice when you're in this thing?
I don't generally offer advice, but I think that it is, they've internalized something. And all that I really need to do is respond graciously. And that reaffirms something in them, that they've found a true connection with me. And I just can't get in the way of that, right? It's just a question of allowing their recognition of me as this important figure in their life and respond graciously and say, wow, thank you. And mm-hmm. because it is kind of an honor.
It is, I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't take it lightly. I mean, I wouldn't say that I kept my name out of the tabloids out of some concern for my fans so much as concern for myself and my own family, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm very aware how deeply some people take this fandom thing.
Yes, it is fascinating.
How meaningful it is for people.
Especially with this show for some reason, because I think they're emotionally connected to the things that were happening to the kids. You know what I mean? They connect on a deep level because maybe it happened to them or happened to their sister or whatever it is. And
yeah. Or they're thinking about it, or they're seeing it around them. There's a wonderful organization and I'm going to blank on their name.
So wonderful you forgot the name.
It's called Advocates for Youth.
Right.
And they're all about, sex education and drug education, all of that stuff. And they recognize the show for their dealing with those kinds of subject matters. But every year they put out a little pamphlet. And what they recommend to parents is to sit down and watch those shows with your kids. Because then you can talk about those kids on the show. What do you mm-hmm. think of those kids on the show and what they're doing, rather than me? You know, right. What teenagers want to do is talk about themselves with their parents.
Yeah, that's very true. I want to ask you, and I asked this to Jim Eckhouse once, was there ever a moment where, as a mom, you were like, I think this is something Cindy may have said. Do you know what I mean? Where it was like a parallel.
Where it sort of pops out of my mouth.
Where you became Cindy in the moment.
Well, I can't remember one, but my son might be able to.
Right. I'm just curious.
And you have to remember, he was a very little boy.
Sure.
Although I swear they go into teenagerhood at 5 these days. Get the same wise ass.
Right. That's really funny. Did he get to spend some time on set as a kid at all? Or did you?
He did come a few times, and at one point he wanted to dye his hair red, and he was, was he in middle school already? Oh, it couldn't have been. No, he might have been in middle school. They start middle school
earlier. Sure.
They did mm-hmm. when I was a kid. So he was right around in there somewhere. And the hairdressers, they said, oh, because he has dark hair, like my dark.
Sure.
They said, oh, this color won't take unless you bleach your hair first, right? It won't show up. So they did. They bleached his hair and then they dyed it and then, of course, he hated it.
Right.
But fortunately, it washed out after a few washes.
That's great.
But I loved the color of his hair because it was a lighter brown.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really attractive on him.
That's amazing.
Pictures of him with that bleached hair.
That's awesome. So looking at the episode, does it hold up for you? Did you have fond memories of this?
Yeah. Or? Well, I think I think it's impressive that Jim even takes his family's wishes into account. That was certainly not the norm when I was growing up. I mean, my father didn't have that kind of a job, but I know that people who did, you know, who were involved in corporate America were often being sent all over the place, and the families just had to go. As a matter of fact, in those days, if your husband got relocated and you as a wife didn't go with him, you were accused. You were accused of leaving him.
Right. Yeah. That's fascinating.
So it was very refreshing to see that. And I mean, I think that's one of Jim's qualities, which makes him such a lodestar as well, is because he is thinking about his family and he cares about his family's happiness. And I mean, and it was so wild to see all those scenes in Minneapolis.
Right.
It was snow, but it was in like spring, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know.
In Minneapolis in May.
They really wanted to show that he was not in LA. Right. Use some snow. It's always snowing in Minnesota. It's
always snowing in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Well, my niece lives in Calgary, and she said she's had to adjust her understanding of the seasons. Fall, winter, and spring all include snow. The only season without snow.
All right. Well, this has been great. Thanks for spending some time with me chatting about this episode. And I hope you have a really lovely time on your trip.
Oh, thank you, Peter. This was really fun. You had some really good questions. Got me thinking.
Good. I'm happy to hear that. This is the last time we see Anna, the maid as well. So is there some battles that are worth fighting and then others that he doesn't want? And then it's what am I going to do?
Saying you saw Anna in the background in that?
I saw Anna, I believe... We see Anna when Cindy's got the plants out. Remember, we were talking about that. Anna is there. She doesn't speak, but she's in the scene. And then we never see her again.
Okay. Well, if that's the cabinet, I remember you saying, "Oh, there's Anna," and I don't remember seeing her. You know, I looked, but mm-hmm. by that point they'd switched the camera. Possibly one of the reasons is that to get her. Lisa to be on the show, I made a deal with her to be in X number of episodes, and we didn't fulfill our obligation. So even if she was there as an extra, we did that. So that might be the rationale there. Mr. Spelling did not, he kind of hamstrung the character of Cindy. He did not want her to have a job. Most women were going out seeking jobs or trying to do that. And she didn't want to have a housekeeper, not a full-time maid, but a woman who comes in once or twice a week, which many is a byproduct of here. And it's a big part of culture in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And so for us to be steered away from it, I think took us away from so many potential episodes, East Side Story notwithstanding.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot more things like that could have happened.
And we would have been absolutely doing. And certainly about people who are here illegally. I would have got into illegals heavily.
Totally.
You know, I mean, one of my pilots that I love the most and was done at ABC and certainly ended, my overall deal ended. It ended like, don't shut the door on the way out, but with Disney. But the project that I had submitted to them for consideration at ABC where my commitment was called Tulio and the Tall Tales of the 20th Century. And it was about Tulio being a 13-year-old kid who had just come to America hiding in a van. So,
It was interesting. Lastly, we see the big party at the end of the episode. We commented when we were watching, you commented when you were watching that, you know, we saw Nat look so young and all these, because we were seeing through the camera. Camera angles and all
everybody
that stuff.
Everybody looked good.
Everybody looked really good. I think the party scene comes together really well, and the audience is equally as connected to the characters now as the characters are to each other. I think there was
And Jim Walsh is so moved by the event that he actually turns and says, "Screw it, we're staying here. I'll deal with it."
And he deals with it.
And he deals with it. And we, you know, it's one of those things where when once in a while with an episode, you say, okay, we're going to do this and do this. We get to the end and they decide to stay home. And then Kenny Loggins comes up singing, "Please celebrate me home." You know, it's what you know, so came around the music, came that moment being key to the creative process in my mind. And of course, nobody who would watch it today would know that that song was so instrumental and created this really joyful mood that washed over the Peach Pit.
Yeah, that's because it's gone. It's been stripped by all the places, so unfortunately. Well, this has been great, Chuck. I think we covered everything in that episode. It was really good one, man. I enjoyed looking back on it. Good season ender, you know, and good stuff, man.
All right, so you'll let me know what the next one is that we'll be doing.
You know it, man.
All right, I'll come back for that.
All right, sounds good, man. Have a good one. Pete.